This episode was originally a live conversation which took place at the CEF Founders Conference in 2023.
Sometimes the most dangerous thing is to be the smartest person in the room, because it means you stop learning, right? And so you're looking for people who actually are really smart, right? They're really ambitious, they are really driven, whatever, right? But they realize that they actually come, they join your company to learn.
Welcome to the Swisspreneur Show, a podcast about startup stories and learnings from experienced entrepreneurs. Here's your host, Sylvan.
It's my big pleasure to welcome our first guest for this afternoon. He grew up in Liestal in Basel, studied at the ETH in Zurich before then moving to the US, pursuing his PhD there at Stanford, starting his own startup company, then successfully exiting it. But most importantly, he joined Google in 1999. Nobody really knew about Google back then, and he was employee number 8. So today, we're going to talk about that journey and also all the learnings along the way. Please welcome Urs Hölzle.
Hi, everyone.
Thank you so much for joining us, Urs.
You're welcome.
So I want to directly jump right in. In 1988, you made the leap from ETH Zurich to Stanford. You did your PhD in computer science. So you're probably the right guy to ask, when is the timing right for Swiss people or Swiss companies to move over to the US?
Maybe right now, maybe never. I think there's no silver bullet in the US. I kind of got there with a plan, but also by accident. This was before the internet. Even applying to an American university was kind of a book of mysteries, you know, meaning, you know, how do you even communicate? You know, you write them letters, right? They send you back contradictory information. So one part of it says, oh, don't worry about tuition, it's free, right? The other says, no matter what anyone tells you, it's not free. And it's, I forget what it was, a lot of money. So anyway, I think it's really up to you to figure out what works best. And there's no silver bullet, but I think it takes, you know, sometimes a little bit of risk and sometimes a little bit of planning, but also just a lot of luck. You know, like right place, right time is not something you can force.
What were you hoping for to find in the U.S. that was missing in Switzerland?
It wasn't actually really about the U.S. I was interested in a particular area of computer science, and it really didn't exist in Switzerland. And it did exist in Stanford and Berkeley. And so I actually applied specifically, you know, to get into the area that I did my PhD in. So it was actually sort of an outcome versus an input. And so I wasn't like, let me go to the U.S. It was really about, like, I'd like to do this, and where are other people doing that and that I could join?
And you then also started a company in the U.S. in the 90s. Would the same journey have been possible in Switzerland back then?
I think back then it was maybe a little bit harder than, like, it's easier today. So for background, my first startup was sort of a spin-off of my PhD thesis. And it really happened, like many of these things happen sort of by accident or by network, right? And so the story ultimately was that someone I met at a scientific conference, he was working on Wall Street and had connections there. And what I was doing in the thesis was at the time relevant to what some people in hedge funds, whatever, were doing. And so that led to the ideas, hey, if we actually made this particular system Smalltalk, you know, a lot faster, then it could be used for financial systems, et cetera, et cetera. And that wasn't a planned thing. It wasn't like, let me study this and then I want to turn it into a company. But really kind of, you know, a set of coincidences led to this startup, right?
So from what I understand so far, it's really this putting yourself out there in a big pond, and then serendipity happens. One connection leads to the other, and eventually a startup was born.
I think so, and I think actually today I would say that in a way many things happen. You know, like someone said something like, you know, luck favors the prepared or something like that. So it's not like planning or preparation doesn't matter, but a lot of it is really about being in the right place at the right time. And that, I think, when I said back then, it would have been hard in Switzerland. In Switzerland and Zurich at the time didn't really have a tech scene at all, right? And in fact, actually, few places in Europe did. And that is something that I feel is quite different today, where these coincidences can actually happen, you know, locally in Switzerland. And, you know, maybe not at the same scale as in Silicon Valley, but they can happen. And that ecosystem is really starting to happen in Zurich, few other places in Europe. And that, I think, is actually one of the key prerequisites for unexpected things, because ultimately startups are about unexpected things and realizing an opportunity that maybe didn't exist a year ago and that maybe won't exist a year later. And so that's really where the coincidence comes in.
In retrospect, it's always clear, you know, being in the right time in the right place at the right time. But to make these decisions in that moment, how did you do that? How did you decide what you want to focus on, or what was an interesting opportunity? Did you have some guiding principles, or was it your sheer enthusiasm that then led you towards these paths?
Yeah, I didn't really have a plan. And I think, like, I definitely wasn't planning to stay in the US for 30 years, which is what eventually happened. I met my wife there. She's German. She also wasn't planning to be in the US for 30 years. So as someone else said, you know, plans are garbage, like useless, but planning is really important. So I do think it's important to have a concept of what you want to optimize for. But at the same time, I think it's not like I would be hard pressed to predict something 2 years into the future. And that's something that I definitely believed in back then as well, where you can't really make it a 5-year plan or a 10-year plan for yourself. That is predictive in any particular way. I wouldn't have predicted that I was going to be faculty, or that I would do the startup, right? Or that I would join another startup. Like, that was really not like in my plan, and I'm just looking for this opportunity. It really happened. And so I think it's really conviction, or the confidence to actually let accidents or coincidences happen. And also the confidence to know that, you know, sometimes the coincidence or the accident doesn't work out. And, you know, 9 out of 10 times, that's actually just how it is, right? And we ascribe success to skill and, you know, failure to bad luck. But actually, both of it actually has a large component of just things that happen that you have a limited amount of influence in. So if it doesn't work, you know, try it again, and maybe the next time it will work.
So in that regard, the saying, the harder you try, the luckier you get, it seems to have some truth.
Yes, but I think there's, you know, I think, to, you know, if you try too hard, then actually you lower your chances. Yeah. And so I think the openness to let things happen that you didn't necessarily mean to happen this way, like sometimes it's called pivot, right? Like some of the most successful startups did not actually start up doing what they ended up succeeding at. That is another way of saying you got to be flexible. And if you're too focused on a particular outcome, or if too trying to impose your plan and your framework on the world, that might not work.
Then after 3 years, you sold your company, your startup. Then 2 years later, in 1999, you joined Google as employee number 8. Take us back to that time. How did you meet the Google founders?
That was another, I think coincidence. So back then I was, you know, faculty at UC Santa Barbara. My wife was still finishing her PhD at Stanford, so I'd been commuting. And after 5 years, the two places are about 500 kilometers, you know, 50-minute plane flight away. After 5 years, that was kind of getting old. And so actually my plan, right, was I want to take a year off. My tenure case was I had the opportunity to do a sabbatical, which really is a nice name for unpaid leave. And so I said my goal is actually I want to bike to work instead of fly to work. And so I was kind of low-level looking, And at the time, the internet bubble was sort of in full swing. You got phone calls every day about this huge, big opportunity. And it was all really very weird because most of those startups had really basically no technology, no business model, whatever. And I wanted to learn something. And so my thing was, hey, I want to go somewhere where it's interesting. And I learned something. And then after a year, my wife would graduate and then we could decide that we would go back to Europe. Right? So that was kind of the plan. And then two separate people told me about Google and said, oh, you should talk to these guys. I actually ignored the first one because, and that's another interesting message actually, you know, I knew it was search and I was completely not a search person, right? I was sort of an infrastructure person, actually a compiler person. And my first instinct was, okay, great, but like they don't really have a need for someone like me because I know absolutely nothing about search, right? And then only after the second one did I actually take a closer look and kind of realized actually they do have a systems problem, right? It's a huge compute problem. It's a huge scaling problem. And they probably have problems that I know something about that have nothing to do with search, but that are still very, very relevant to search. And so that one thing led to another. And that's when I ended up saying, well, why don't I take a year off and join these people?
Amazing. So yeah. The plan changed slightly.
Well, it definitely shows you about the predictability of even a one-year plan. So yes, yeah.
I also want to talk about the sort of the culture and the organizational change. So what does it do to an organization like Google, one of the probably most high-performing companies out there ever, if the employee sizes just keep doubling and doubling, you get bigger and bigger? What does that mean in terms of culture and also perceiving and building a culture?
Yeah, great question. I think that's actually something that is probably the number one reason why companies fail is because they don't pay attention to how to grow. And they put growth sort of before correct growth, if you want, and hire the wrong talent or hiring the wrong place or don't pay attention to culture. So today I would say that's even more important than what we thought back then. That's in fact the hardest question to some extent, much harder than, you know, making search better or having things scale.
And how do you tackle that at Google? I mean, as employee number 8, you have seen the whole journey, right? So how did the company evolve and also purposefully and consciously actually shape the culture to become the company it is today?
Yeah, so it's really, again, it's something that in retrospect, I'd say, you know, should have paid even more attention to. There's many smart people who have written about it, but, you know, I think a sentence I like is you know, culture eats strategy for breakfast. Like you can have the right strategy. If you have the wrong culture, it does not matter at all whether you have the right strategy or the wrong strategy. At the same time, if you have the right culture, it actually doesn't matter whether you have the wrong strategy or the right one, because you will find the right one. Because people are, you know that how to contribute, know how to contradict you, you know how to correct. And so two things. I think the first one is you have to worry about it. That's really the most important thing, right? Because you have smart people worrying about a problem, then they usually, you know, do well. And then the second thing is that you have to sort of recognize that there is no one solution that lives forever. Like if, as you said, you know, if you keep doubling, there are some things that just cannot survive, right? Like at a certain size, you just cannot operate the same way. And so the key thing, and that's actually the hard part, is what do you hold on to, right? What do you say, actually, even at 1,000 people, we want to be the same as when we were 10 people in this aspect. And in other things, you say, look, actually it makes no sense at 1,000 people to run things the same way or to believe in the same things as a 10-person company. And therefore, here we deliberately, or at least we permit the change to evolve away from where you are. And that ultimately is the tricky question. No silver bullet, but that's the hard part.
I like the part you said first, you know, you have to worry about culture. Is there also a way to measure culture? Did you perform that at Google in any way?
I think, you know, you have your surveys and et cetera, but I think actually it's one of these things where you know it by the outcomes. And I would actually say two things. One is, so today it's called Actually, I don't know what you call it in Europe, but in the US, it's often called psychological safety. And that means that actually people are free to speak up and to contradict others in the position of authority, right? Meaning that even though I am just a team member and not the boss, if I see something that seems wrong, I'm like, hey, you know, why are we doing this? This seems wrong because et cetera, et cetera. And so one way to measure a good culture is if you see that actually happening, right? Because people are very good at picking up cues. And if you discourage that, even if you discourage it unintentionally, they will learn very quickly that contradicting your superior is not welcome, and therefore it's silence, right? And so when you see it actually happen, that means that clearly the environment that enables it is there, right? And why is it so important? It's because ultimately that, especially in the early years, is a safety net, right? Like you're making decisions very quickly. It's extremely unlikely that they are all correct decisions, right? That just, you know, is unlikely to happen. But if you have smart people, and if the smart people know that they can actually speak up, even if someone who they think of as a superior made the wrong decision, that is your safety net, right? Because you have two important metrics. One is sort of mean time between making, mean time between failure, MTBF, or mean time between making a bad decision, right? So let's say you're probably making a bad decision every week, right? But the second one is MTTR, mean time to repair. Like how quickly does it take, how long does it take to recognize and correct that mistake, right? If you make a mistake every week, but you fix it in an hour, no problem, right? If you make a mistake every month, but it takes you half a year to fix it, huge problem, right? So it's not about how often you fail or how often you make mistakes, but it's actually really how is the corrective function? How is the safety net? How is the autocorrect, right? If you want, that's in the organization, not in your spell checker.
The culture autocorrect.
That's actually what you want, right? And that is true for cultural things. Like, why do we talk to each other this way or whatever? And it's true for technical things. You know, why do we build it this way or that? It might actually be true for business things and actually for your pivot. Like, why do we try to solve this problem when our users or our customers are telling us really that they care about this other thing much more?
So it's really about adaptability and also the speed of adaptability.
Exactly, right? And that the organization actually believes in solving it together versus following, you know, some golden path that has been divined by, you know, wise people.
Right. And obviously culture is made up of people. So I also wonder, you've worked with many different teams within Google. What do you look for in people? What attitude, what sort of characteristic of people do you look for when you set up a team or when you hire someone?
I mean, that's really a hard question to answer because it's, you know, dozens of things, right? But I actually think the two key things are, one is, you know, it's not just about the individual person, but the team that they come into. And so a good question to ask is what do they add to the team, right? Because sometimes it's tempting to hire people in the template of what you already have because these employees have made you strong and made you successful. But if you have too uniform a team, that actually doesn't work, right? So that's one thing, you know, what do you actually, where do I need to add talent, skills, et cetera? And then the second one really is, can you be, as a person, you know, can you be serious, ambitious, opinionated, you know, et cetera, but open to feedback and open to being corrected by someone else, right? And do you realize that actually you have to learn, right? Sometimes the most dangerous thing is to be the smartest person in the room because it means you stop learning, right? And so you're looking for people who actually are really smart, right? They're really ambitious. They are really driven, whatever, right? But they realize that they actually come, they join your company to learn and become even better, right? And so that I think would be my number one and my number two question to ask. And then, of course, everything else is lots of domain-specific things as well.
And in that process, do you also have any red flags that you say, hey, if this happens or if this shows, it's not going to work?
Yes, easily. I mean, I think culture flags are definitely a big thing because, again, if you take this seriously, then you have to realize that sometimes the person who is absolutely the right person from a domain perspective, you know, they have exactly the skills you want. But if they're not the right from a cultural perspective, like, you know, my way or the highway or, you know, whatever, right? So there's often, you know, fairly easy red flags. The good thing is that often those people are unaware of their weakness and therefore it's easy to see. I remember actually way back when, you know, first 2-3 years that we were talking to someone, very, very strong guy. And so one question was, well, how do you deal in your current job? How do you deal with a disagreement? And he was like, oh, you know, they call me the howitzer because I blow them away. Like, okay, thank you. Honest answer. Anyway, I think it takes, to go back, actually, let me ask, give you a meta answer to a complicated question. You know, think about how do you actually hire people? Do your employees, do you yourself know how to hire people and how to tell, you know, fit from not fit? And often the answer is no, actually. I think I do. But reading up on it is actually a good idea. There's lots of great guides on the internet. And they actually, you learn a lot, right? Because you're actually probably not good at it because you haven't done it before.
I have one last question in the organizational culture part. If you have two teams, you have a team that performs very well and you have a team that doesn't perform well at all, which one is more stressful for you to manage?
Well, that's really easy. That's the second one, of course. That's actually one of the harder things to learn. The truth is that if you lead any kind of team, you actually end up spending the majority of your time on people who are a problem of one sort of another. Sometimes that's a good thing because they really just need some mentoring or help, right, to really bloom. But often it's really actually waiting too long to admit that it's not working and being able to actually take action on that. And that's a hard thing because often it's not about the person being bad, but the fit being wrong, right? Like what they're good at, you know, and what you need are two separate things. So that to me, I think, is one thing where, again, from a culture perspective, it's really hard to have a high performance culture where you can actually expect high performance and fire people, but at the same time have a safe culture as well, where people know they can, for example, object, right, to something you're doing or whatever, right? And not feel that, well, if I'm noisy, then I get fired, right? Because people don't want dissent. So balancing that is a tricky part, but it's actually, you spend all your time with problems, and often problems are, you know, problem teams, right? Not necessarily problem people.
There's one last topic that I want to dive into with you. It's the topic of artificial intelligence, AI. How do you observe the current development? What does that mean for all of us and also for Google eventually?
It's actually very, I think it's actually very interesting to see sort of the general Zeitgeist, to use a German word, and the public awareness, because, you know, I think there's been an inflection point, let's say, in the last 6 months, even though in the underlying technology, that inflection point does not exist, right? So the most surprising thing to me about AI is that starting about roughly 10 years ago, there's really been strong progress every single year. And but a lot of it happened without mastering language. And what happened in the last 2 years was that actually, you know, AI was, you know, became able to generate language that seems like human language. Like, you know, in at the sentence level, at a paragraph level, at a little essay level, it is just well-written text. Not necessarily correct text, but really well-written text that makes you feel like it's not written by a machine, but it's written by a human. And I think to us, this really has an emotional appeal. That kind of led to this inflection point in public thinking about what AI is, even though actually in the underlying technology and sort of the path, it really was, you know, getting from pretty good to very good to excellent on this job. So if you looked at publications, experiments, et cetera, you could have seen that 18 months ago. And it wasn't quite perfect yet, and it wasn't in a public tool, but it was, you know, on that trajectory where you could sort of guess that, well, actually another year, and this is probably pretty good.
Right. And there are also some myths, you know, being handed around about AI. Are there some things that you see that AI will absolutely not be able to solve and where you say, hey, this is just a myth, this will never happen in real life?
I wouldn't say it that way. I think one of the things that the last 10 years really were surprising at compared to the previous, let's say, 50 years of AI. In the previous 50 years of AI, there were sort of, you know, peaks and valleys, you know, a spurt where people really made a lot of progress and they thought, wow, we're on this path. And then it stalled. And for 5-10 years, it really was just stalling. And so the most surprising things in the last 10 years is that when DNN started, it was something like 2013, every year the progress continued in a pretty, you know, strong and continuous way, right? And so now in 10 years, the cumulative path that we've gone is really impressive. And so therefore, it's hard to say never this, never that, right? I think one of the things that to me surprises you is that, as surprises me, is that I do think people anthropomorphize AI a little bit too much right now. Meaning, here's something, it spits perfect language at you, and you therefore actually sort of see the human as a machine behind it, and you really overestimate its abilities, because its ability to generate language is as good as yours, right? But, you know, from that concluding that its ability to do reasoning is the same as yours is really not valid, right? And so that, I think, is the biggest myth today, that to generate language, you have to actually be as cognitively, you know, like a similar way, cognitive like we are. That's definitely not true today, and I think that confuses a lot of people. Someone, you know, once said not too long ago, the LLM is the perfect BS generator, right? Like, it very convincingly will tell you something, and you have no idea whether it's complete BS or whether it's true, because it's convincing. Like, it sounds like someone who knows what they're doing, but actually behind, it's not necessarily the case, right? So that, I think, is a myth that for us to actually get to a point where it's not BS, but 99% of the time it is actually something true, that is still a pretty big step that is left. Right? I wouldn't bet against it, right? If the progress continues, but it you know, we're not close. Right?
Well, I think that's a great reminder to keep in mind when we talk about the AI topic. So to wrap up, Urs, you have been in Silicon Valley for quite some time now. What is your future? What are your plans for the future? What do they look like?
So we don't actually live in Silicon Valley anymore. I now visit, but we left the US after 30 years. You know, I think Silicon Valley still, I think what distinguishes it is that the scale of everything, meaning mostly the scale of talent, makes kind of those probabilities, those coincidences that I mentioned, makes them more likely to work out for you, right? And that's sort of a distinguishing factor. It's actually kind of like for hardware, Shenzhen or so is similar kind of place where in hardware, like everything is within 10 kilometers that you need. And so certain things can just happen more frictionless. That, I think, is really still true. I think what has changed is that because of the internet, and actually because of, you know, 20 years of technology evolution, now there's actually more places that are lacking the scale but actually have a similar dynamic and a similar ecosystem where accidents can happen, where the right coincidences lead to a breakthrough. And it's not really that much limited to Silicon Valley, or actually Boston was one of those places, you know, but back then. Today there's many, many Bostons, right, including in Europe. And back then there wasn't. So in that sense, I think Silicon Valley has lost a little bit of its unassailable position. But at the same time, the scale actually, scale is scale, right? It still matters. And so I think it has a bright future for quite a while.
With your personal move, you went the other direction. You went over to the Pacific instead of the Atlantic Ocean. Do you ever miss Switzerland?
Yes. And it's far away now, further than it was before. Actually, New Zealand, so I live in New Zealand these days. It reminds me a lot of Switzerland in the sense that, you know, small country reinvents everything from scratch, even though it's been solved 50 times outside already, because there's a special situation. It has its version of Germany as a big, dominant, culturally similar neighbor in Australia. And it has mountains and glaciers, but also beaches. So in that sense, there's a plus. But then the big thing actually is that, you know, it really is easy to collaborate these days. And the one thing that is not easy is time zones. And so, you know, might not quite realize where New Zealand is on the map, but it's only between 3 and 5 hours away from California time zone wise. So it's actually very practical to work with a California-based company.
Fantastic. Urs, thank you so much for joining us here today and for your thoughts and insights. All right. Urs Hölzer, everyone.
Thank you, too. Yes.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you did, you can support us by rating our show on Apple Podcasts. This way, we can reach an ever-growing number of aspiring entrepreneurs.